2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 262. George Romney, Maverick Mormon Activist. Papers presented by Jay Bonner Ritchie and Sue Burden.
Yeah. well, that means it's just 50.
Yeah, I think they would. I know that they would be talking about the door that we don't have.
It's going to be middle.
Yeah, it's called back. Yeah, we're going to go.
Introduction and then good afternoon and welcome to this particular session involving a biographical information on George Romney being presented by Bonna Ritchie, a retired professor from BYU, and I am quoting from my Sunstone cheat sheet here. It says, "Note to session chair, this person didn't respond in time to our recent request for more complete biographical information." So you're fortunate. You're not going to get... And I have the same note for Sue. So she responded, but we hit it. But anyway, I'm going to turn it over to them. As I said to Bonner, I have to go to a doctor's appointment. I have reached that stage of life where they don't care anymore about my private life, just my private part. So my doctor and I are going to have fun. So enjoy.
This feels inordinately far from everybody, but I guess we can't change that. So,
well, we could, but... A few years ago, 1998, we had a dedication of the George Romney Institute of Public Management at BYU. And this followed a gift that was given by the Romney family to create the Romney Institute. And I was fortunate enough to be part of that organization at that time, and was the only one in the Institute that had a personal relationship with George. And so as part of the gift, part of the grant was included the writing of a biography of George Romney. And so Dale Wright, another faculty member in the Institute, and I were asked to write this biography. There were several biographies of George that were written in his early career when he was sort of ended when he ran for president. That's kind of when they stopped. But there were several that analyzed his time as an auto executive and governor of Michigan and a variety of roles that he had played in after World War II and Reconstruction and war mobilization and lobbyist and then his aborted run for president. But there hasn't been much done since then. There hasn't been much written since that time about him. And so we were asked to do so. So Dale and I, neither one of us are historians or writers, although we've each written a few things, but we're certainly not biographers. And so we started doing interviews. And as we did more and more interviews, the stories became so compelling. The drama became so rich, and we really got hooked. It was really fun to see chief executives of major organizations, of people like Colin Powell and George Bush, first George Bush, all say that George was their inspiration for all that they had done. I was fortunate enough to attend the Points of Light National Convention, can't remember what it was, 4 years ago, where Colin Powell received the George and Lenore Romney award, for volunteer service, exemplary volunteer service in America or something. And Colin Powell said that George was the inspiration for him in starting his America's Promise, the organization reaching out to youth in America. He says that George was the one that inspired him to do that. And his wife, Alma Powell, said that George was by far the most important symbol in her life of public service. And George Bush said we never would have had 1,000 Points of Light without George Bush, without George Romney. And we kept hearing these stories. A person, a very impressive business executive who owned two professional sports franchises, and said it was George who came and told me that I was behaving immorally and I had to shape up and I had to put so much of my money back into the public wheel, that I had to get my players involved in Newark, New Jersey, and other things. He says, I never would have done it without George. And that story repeated itself over and over and over again. Well, after we'd done, I don't know how many interviews, 40, 50, something, Dale and I realized we were in over our head, and so we had to hire somebody that was competent in dealing with this. And so I had previous experience with Sue Bergen, who is a remarkable writer and scholar and works hard, as contrasted to some of the rest of us. And so we got Sue involved in making sense of this data, and then the three of us did a series of additional interviews, and then Sue did some on her own. And so we've got up to a fair number of interviews with some very interesting and telling people in public and private life. Well, the grant to establish the Romney Institute was looking at George Romney as a role model for students in several areas. It's a business school, the Marriott School, and it's the Romney Institute of Public Management within the Marriott School. Looking at a person with enormous integrity, we never had anybody who ever said that they thought George had misrepresented or lied or was not honest. In fact, his honesty was one of his weaknesses. But that's, one could do worse in terms of weaknesses than honesty. But a role model for students, his public service, his service as a citizen is in many respects more impressive than his service as a CEO of a major corporation, American Motors. His downsizing, he was the father of downsizing cars. His Rambler was the first compact car, the first attempt to eliminate what he called the gas-guzzling dinosaurs of the immoral Ford, GM, and Chrysler empires. And he didn't mix any words about it. George resigned from the Detroit Athletic Club, which was the power center of Detroit society, which is the power center of the American automobile industry. And George resigned because they would not admit African-Americans or Jews or women. And I don't think he mentioned women in his resignation.
I don't think he cared too much about that at the time.
But blacks and Jews were very clear, and he resigned at a time when he was ridiculed. He was way ahead of his time when he did that.
That would have been in the 50s, late 50s or early 60s.
Yeah. Way before the Martin Luther King and civil rights. Anyway, so George just did all these things. He thought he would be a really good role model, and it would honor him and would be a role model for students. And so that was the creation of the Institute and the grant that allowed us to write the book. Well, the book's about done. It's about ready to come out.
It's about ready to be finished writing, not quite ready to come out.
She was more careful than that. But Dale cut out and is on a church mission in Estonia?
I can't remember.
Ukraine? Anyway, so it's left to Sue and I, which means Sue will immediately finish the volume and it will be ready for publication. But this is a remarkable man, a church leader. George had the ability to criticize and still be accepted. My fondest memory of George Romney was after I accepted an assignment at the my first faculty assignment at the University of Michigan. And when we went back there, George Romney was governor of Michigan. And one of my cynical, critical colleagues said, "George Romney makes you one proud to be a Mormon in Michigan." And that was helpful. I sort of appreciated that. But then the next state conference was the state conference following the assassination of Martin Luther King. And George invited himself to speak at state conference. He never waited for invitations from anybody, including general authorities. And George invited himself to speak at state conference. And he gave the most stirring tribute to Martin Luther King. It was one of those moments that I still can remember how I felt. I had been a little bit involved in civil rights activities and some protest movements during my days at Berkeley, and George sort of symbolized in the most compelling fashion the things I cared about, the things that were important to me, and he could take on the church in terms of blacks in the priesthood, and still be state president or region representative or patriarch or whatever. His faith was unwavering, but his independence was extreme, and a fun combination of a person. Well, so that's sort of the backdrop for what we've been doing, and Sue has the facts. I have the stories, and Sue has the facts. So she's going to give you a few backdrop facts here to frame the life of this remarkable guy.
I just thought we'd go over some fun facts about George, some interesting facts that will illuminate his personality, and we'll talk about his personality too. He chased Lenore, his wife of 63 years when he died, for 7 years before he caught her. That's a long story. You can see their photos up here. He kissed his children on the lips.
She was a She was an actress.
She was an actress.
With stage and movie contracts. And he just dogged her to the end till she had to give in.
She had an offer for a $50,000 a year contract with MGM, and she had to make a decision whether to take that or marry George, and she finally decided to marry George. I was saying he kissed his children on the lips, including his boys, even after they became adults. This is a little story. He once bypassed the Secret Service at President Bush's Kennebunkport compound and let himself into the house. This was about 1991 when he was 84. President Bush was startled to find George in his living room.
George had a message, and he wasn't going to be deterred.
Yeah, he had something to say, and he was going to make sure he said it. We should be clear that the last 23 years of his life, after he left the Housing and Urban Development Department under Nixon, he was 65 when he left that, he spent the next 23 years till his death at 88 working on embedding a volunteer culture into American life. And that's a lot of what we'll talk about, because the political stuff is pretty well known. Let's see. Joan Kroc, the widow of McDonald's founder Ray Kroc, gave George a card that got him free money at any McDonald's. Free food. At any McDonald's. And he used it constantly. He was very proud of this card, and apparently it was just a tattered piece of nothing by the time he was done with it.
A lifetime. It was lifetime.
It was lifetime.
Food.
And we don't know the back. I would, if anybody happens to know that scenario of why she gave that to him and when, we'd love to know. We don't have those details. And he frequented the McDonald's that Bill Clinton made famous on his jogging stops. So that was the one he liked the best.
George is famous for walking out of White House lunches to go to McDonald's to save the government money.
I hadn't heard that one. That's good.
he walked out on Bush one time. They had a luncheon prepared at some luncheon morning, and he left. He just left. He says that this is absurd. He said, "You don't need to feed me." And he went out and got his free McDonald's.
Yeah, he was well known for taking his meals from the baskets, the fruit baskets left in nice hotels. He would just take the banana and the apple and then buy a little yogurt or something, and that was his meal. He just didn't care about things like that at all. He and Lenore, of course, entertained dignitaries all the time, and they served alcohol in their home. They made that choice. He played a strange game of solo golf that he called compact golf. This was just for exercise. He'd whack three balls at a time around three or four holes and just by himself. And sometimes he would do it early in the morning before it was light, and he made sure the balls were glow-in-the-dark. He often poked people in the chest when he was talking to them with an index finger or the arm of his glasses. Apparently he was well known for that. Very forceful personality. A lot of urgency always in everything he said. In 1960, he had recently become famous as the man who saved American Motors, and he decided with that clout, I guess, that he would write to the two candidates for president, Kennedy and Nixon, and chide them for what he called glossing over basic issues, and then he released the letter to the press for attention, and which it got. He refused to work on Sundays, including campaigning, and his campaign managers always said at the beginning, yeah, you say that now, but he stuck to it all the way through every campaign. We've come across a few exceptions, one of which was he marched with Martin Luther King in Detroit the month before King gave his I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. It was kind of a practice run of that speech, and George was there, and it was a Sunday. He lived by quotes. His children and his grandchildren can quote the things he used to say over and over again, such as, money helps, but only people can solve problems. And the danger from within is greater than any danger from without, talking about American society. He talked about how volunteer centers should be as plentiful as the post office. And these are things that just about everyone we interviewed would quote him about those things and say how often he said them. He also loved to quote DNC 90:24, which is search diligently, pray always, and be believing and all things shall work together for your good. I think some of those give you an idea of his personality. Just a couple of other things. He was extremely intense and focused and forceful and always in a hurry. Greg Petersmeyer, who was the first one of the founding board members of America's Promise, he said, "I think there was a kind of moral urgency to essentially every conversation I had with him. There was an urgency about the right thing to do and the need to aspire to do urgently the right thing." And again, we got these same similar comments from many, many people. He was always on task. There was very little downtime. His daughters described how at their family cottage and on Lake Huron, they go up there to rest and relax, and George would have a briefcase and books and these ubiquitous yellow pads that he was always writing ideas on. And he'd sit in the middle of the room where all the grandchildren were playing, and he would just be focused on what he was doing. But he wanted to be with people, with his family and with his children and grandchildren, but he also had to make the time useful in another, the way he thought was useful, I guess. Extremely confident bearing, striking appearance. You can see his appearance here even as he got older. He was apparently, that shock of gray hair just was very striking, and people commented on it often. A friend said he was the type of personality that the minute he walked into a room, you knew he was there. It wasn't strident, it wasn't brassy, it wasn't pushy, it was just a presence. And then, of course, they all talk about his absolute integrity. He was not particularly good with speeches. His rhetoric could be fuzzy, and he often resorted to platitudes like the quotes I talked about. One Michigan professor said, "George sees everything through a beautiful fog." The right words elude him, and in their place come platitudes, pieties, talk about fundamental basic relationships that simply frustrate inquiry. This was some of his problem in his campaigns, and as a politician, newsmen would want, they were mostly men at the time, but news people would press him for details and about some of the stands he would take, and he would just sort of resort to these platitudes because he apparently hadn't thought through things in some cases. We have lots more. That's probably enough for the moment about that.
As Sue was talking, I thought of another one. When I was interviewing a woman who was the executive director of the, what was it, second largest volunteer center in the country, and up on the wall was a quote. And this quote, she said, came from George. I've never seen anything where he said it, where we have documentation. But she was one of the early volunteer leaders in America. And the quote says that volunteerism is not an act of charity. It is an act of citizenship. And that if everybody is not volunteering to improve the country, to improve the community, to improve the world, then they are not, they have no claim on virtue, on citizenship, on anything else. That volunteering to make a difference is an act, a basic act of citizenship. It's kind of it's a strong statement of a commitment, of a value system, of an orientation of a person. A couple of other things. Let me back up just a little bit to when George was at American Motors. In those days, there were a lot of strikes in the auto industry. There were a lot of strikes in steel industry and lots of sectors of American economic life. And that was the world I was particularly close to in my early academic career. And in one of these strikes, the companies, of course, wanted the contracts to expire in the winter so that the strikers had to picket in the miserable, absolutely miserable cold of Hamtramck or Flint or Dearborn or Detroit. And so this was a winter strike, American Motors. And there were two parts of this story. And this information comes from Irving Bluestone, who is head of research for the United Auto Workers, and reinforced, as I recall, by Doug Fraser, who was later president of the United Auto Workers, who we interviewed. And it was cold, and those of you who haven't had the fortunate privilege of marching on picket lines in January in Michigan, don't realize that it's humid and biting cold, and they would get these 50-gallon drums, and then they would bring in wood and or kerosene or whatever they had and light them on fire to keep warm as they marched the picket line. Well, they ran out of wood. And so George got a pickup truck and went out and bought some wood, and I'm sure with his own money. Yeah, I don't know that, but I'm sure with his own money. Bought the wood, brought it in, and delivered it at the warming stations of the strikers. Everybody admitted that no other CEO of an auto company ever did that in a strike. Well, not only that, but in the final days of the negotiations, where the auto workers thought they had received a pretty good contract, they thought they had sort of accomplished their goals. And George came in and said, "We need to make some changes. We need to correct the data. The data that we gave you made us, American Motors, look worse than we really are. There's more money that can go on the table for negotiation." And the Bluestone said, "We never would have known. I mean, this is unheard of for an executive to admit that they had given us data that wasn't quite accurate, and they would modify and correct the data that would be to their disadvantage." But that was George. And I suspect he never thought of it politically or even negotiation. He never thought of it as a strategic issue. It was just the honest thing to do. If you have good data, you give it. And if it goes against you, that's the way it goes. You don't debate. You don't agonize. You don't ever wonder if you should do it. You just do it because of a principle. And I found that a rather telling story. And I think it's worth noting that Walter Reuther had died, but Doug Fraser was still living when George died, and was at his funeral and gave the ex-president of the United Auto Workers and gave some interviews that are really touching in terms of this man. And we interviewed him, and he said there's just never been another George Romney. He was one of a kind and just an absolutely unique individual, and not very many union leaders talked about CEOs of auto companies that way. It's a rather impressive story. What about the brainwashing?
Do you want to talk about brainwashing? Yeah. Comment?
Dave?
Will you also talk about his childhood and how he got to America?
Oh, sure. Sure.
Listen. I don't know, will we? Yeah, we will. The brainwashing, he's most famous in many people's minds for the brainwashing incident, which was basically in preparation for him running for president in the 1968 election. In 1967, he toured Vietnam, and he came back, and it took him a little while. It wasn't immediately, but he realized over time that he had not been told the truth by the various military officials in Vietnam, and it became clear to him that they were lying about what was going on. And he said on a local talk show program in Detroit, "I just got the worst brainwashing a person can get." That was his statement about it. It was just vintage George, just frank, candid, you know, just sort of whatever comes to mind is what he says. Didn't measure his words, you know, was not careful like politicians are now and like most of them were then. And of course, this did not go over well. If he has a brain that's susceptible to brainwashing, then he's not presidential material.
He flip-flops.
He flip-flops. They didn't have that term then. Yeah. There was a big uproar. Of course, the press grabbed onto this, and it was repeated and repeated over and over again. He withdrew from the presidential race a couple weeks before the New Hampshire primary and a few weeks after this statement. And most pundits now say that's why he withdrew. It's a little unclear. He did say a number of times that is not why he withdrew. He withdrew because Nelson Rockefeller was about to enter, and he said that he just couldn't go against Rockefeller.
But the telling thing is how it got to that point. because his numbers went down dramatically after the brainwashing statement.
Right.
And so it wasn't that he withdrew because of that, it's that he lost the polling numbers as a result of that.
That was a lot of humor. I was saying, you got the quickest break in town in the country.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Bill?
Yeah, I remember reading an article, I think it was in the Progressive magazine, after he withdrew, which contended that there really was an anti-Mormon bias in the media, and you could link that to him getting such a workout in the media for the brainwashing statement, that there was possibly another person that wasn't, you know, more favored by the media, even getting better treatment over the brainwashing, or a rather logical statement about brainwashing.
Right.
And I don't know whether either of you have any notion as to whether or not religious prejudice played at all into him losing support and the brainwashing statement being so.
You know, that is so hard to determine because, you know, I read a lot of the clippings from that period, and you just don't know what's in the minds of the people who are doing the writing without asking them, and of course they're not going to admit it even if they did have that prejudice. My sense is there was probably some, but I'm not sure there was that much. There certainly was the blacks and the priesthood issue that came up a lot, and he had to defend himself on that point a great deal.
Also, in the same article, said that he was in Alaska on a Saturday and then was taking Sunday off. And this particular reporter went to the board meeting on Sunday. None of the press went to the board meeting. This reporter is saying, you know, the reporter should have gone to the board meeting. He spoke at the board meeting second Saturday, and this reporter said he gave a good insight into the man. So the secular journalist confused it.
Sue's read the reports, but I remember them live in Detroit at the time, and there were a lot of questions that didn't always get put in the recorded report, but at a news conference or at a television interview or at a talk show, questions about what he would do if there were a national crisis on Sunday. And would he call, who would it have been, President McKay? Who was President of the Church? Yeah, McKay. Would he call President McKay if he needed advice on national policy? And could he work with women? Could he work with minority, with blacks? And there were a lot of those questions. And they weren't necessarily loaded in the final report, but they were in the process, and I think that led to a bias.
Did Joe Lieberman get that too, though?
Absolutely, Lieberman got it, yeah. And John Kennedy got it. I mean, those of us who remember that campaign, he got an enormous amount of guff about a Catholic being president and the Pope running America and Lieberman and his Jewish orthodoxy, and what would he do on Saturday? So this was not new or unique to George.
And let me just add briefly, when Mitt Romney ran for senator against Teddy Kennedy in 1994, and these questions came up about Mitt, George, who campaigned heavily for Mitt, brought up John Kennedy's arguments defending his Catholicism again, and George used that against Teddy. It was very interesting.
What was interesting is about that time I was running for my class vice presidency at Annapolis. He had come through. One of the plebes had written a sign that said, "Romney and Haynes, 68 Bull Warner." Only six classmates were formed, but as a result of that, to show you what happens, I was contacted by six national journalists to try and make a statement against him concerning the Paul Books, the little sign. I gave him a copy of that sign, and it came to
That's fun.
It was really interesting that they went to that extreme to try and
discredit.
It was like it was an active program, so I was pushing. I got through the great line that Eisenhower was.
Well, the church was still small. The church was still small and unknown, and we didn't have a Gordon Hinckley doing press conferences and going on 60 Minutes. And so there was we were a cult phenomenon in the world, and so the news was kind of interesting. Some of the news was good the racehorse, who was the racehorse? Was that?
Secretary?
Was that? No, that wasn't the Mormon racehorse.
Oh, the Mormon racehorse. No, there was a Mormon.
Who was it?
They said baptized.
No, there's a Mormon racehorse. The one the Derby, and his 10% of his winnings were going to church, and that was a big deal, and that was fairly positive. Ezra Taft Benson had both positive and negative results from his time in the White House, but it was still a small cult with a kind of awkward way of handling the press, and I think that's important. Alan?
Well, just two comments. I was teaching at Columbia University in 1967-68, living in New Jersey, and I was appointed to a committee of a Romney committee by Henry Beckman, who was head of the Beckman Dickinson Medical Technology and Supplies Company. I remember what tremendous respect those executives had. That's number one. Number two is almost across the street from Columbia was the Inner Church Center, known at that time as the Protestant Vatican, where they had the headquarters of many Protestant religions, including also the Greek Orthodox Church. And when they found out I was a Mormon, they asked me to come in light of Romney's visibility at that time as a candidate for president, to discuss with them Mormonism, politics, and the whole business. And there were a couple of tremendously interesting things. Number one was they were terrified that Romney might get elected, that a Mormon might get elected. Secondly, they wanted to know all about the blacks for sheep. And then thirdly, a lot about just performing as much. And I don't think it was just a cult in their eyes. At that time, they saw it as an up-and-coming religion, and they were concerned about its growth. And we had some really good discussions, and as a result of that, I was invited to speak to Protestant and Catholic congregations and groups in New York and New Jersey at that time. But I think it just tickled me in a way to think that they were scared. It turned out to be a really pleasant experience. Ultimately, it started a number of dialogues between LDS and LDS. So George had a tremendous effect on the group.
He was a powerful personality. We need to shift to the volunteer years because that's people don't know about.
I want to go back to Dave's point just briefly, though.
Okay.
George was born in Mexico,
yes.
And his family moved to Oakley, Idaho, when he was a little boy. And at the dedication of the Romney Institute, it was fun to hear David Haight, who is a childhood friend of George in Oakley, talk about some of the childhood pranks that Haight and Romney pulled off as they were kids, and as they would go swimming in their coveralls in the canal on Sunday, and the story of these two little boys growing up, and we asked Elder Haight what he thought the secret of George's success was, if he saw in those early years growing up in Oakley and you know, kind of a rural world, and not terribly cosmopolitan, and if he saw that any secrets or anything at that time that would predict, and he said, "Well, he said you weren't in that interview, were you?"
No.
with Elder Haight. He said, "Well, George was a very lively little boy," and he says, "I just have to conclude that God made George unique," and I don't know what you do with that except just smile and say thank you. But he said, I just think God made George unique. That passion, that boundless energy, that capacity to even as a kid, he said, he saw that. He said, I could just never keep up with him. And Elder Haight was a fairly assertive, aggressive person as in his growing up years. And he said, I could just never keep up with him. And then George, sort of moved on and became a firebrand missionary in Hyde Park in London, and decided that enthusiasm and emotion were more important than logic and reason in his delivery style. And he did have a delivery style. He was good looking and very aggressive at that time, and he attributed to his mission experience an enormous part of who he was. And that was the time when he decided that he didn't have ambition. And I find that a really interesting point. He said he didn't have ambition for position, but he did have ambition for service. And if he needed position in order to serve, then that's what you do. But he didn't have an ambition to make money, and he never did make much money. He didn't have an ambition to receive position when he headed up the Constitutional Convention to change the Constitution of Michigan. He was just trying to be a good public servant, and he was a kind of reluctant candidate for governor after that was finished, because Michigan was a Democratic state. They had Soapy Williams, who was a popular Democratic governor, overwhelming Democratic legislature, and a United Auto Workers that was firmly Democratic until George Romney came along, and a black community in Detroit that was clearly Democratic until George Romney came along, and of course he won three times. And we were in Michigan during the riots, the Detroit riots of 1967. And George moved out of the State House and onto 12th Street in Detroit. If you know Detroit, 12th Street was the heart of the Detroit riots and the fires, and they were still burning. And he moved in to a police station, slept on a cot, walked the streets with the police and by himself during what was one of America's more extreme cases of civil unrest. And George just had enormous love and support from people. And I remember vividly Gates Brown, who is not a name that goes down in history as a great baseball player, but he was an outfielder on the Detroit Tigers team at the time, one of the few black players on the Detroit team, interestingly enough. And Gates Brown said that it was George Romney's sheer personality that solved the Detroit riots. George's explanation was it was the World Series in 67 when the Detroit Tigers beat the St. Louis Cardinals, and that unified Detroit. George was always saying, well, it's not me. It was the World Series. Nelson got into the campaign, and so I pull out. But George, in those early days, learned to serve and had this passion to serve. And he was going to do whatever it took to serve. And that doesn't come to everybody, but it did come to him. And everybody's kind of mystified, and I think Elder Haight's response is about as good as you can get. George was made different by God for some reason.
I would have to say I didn't see that. He dismissed the brainwashing thing as often as he could. You know, it was nothing. It's in the past. He'd had the interest in... We need to make a distinction here. He had this very lofty idea of voluntary action. Volunteerism is, you know, kind of painting a needy person's house. And his idea was much broader and bigger than that, which was that strategically... when there are problems in communities, people need to get together and strategize and look at the big picture and prevent crises and use their own brains and their own resources, not the government, not the not even the church necessarily, although you can bring all these things together, but it's people in their neighborhood. You see a problem, you get together and you and you solve it, or in your city, or in your nation. And it sort of shifted to the volunteerism concept a little later, because that became a more practical way to implement his ideas and his thoughts. But still, he wanted these volunteer centers, of which there are about 400 in the United States right now, to address these bigger problems and to be a resource for people to get together and strategize. And he saw the civil rights movement as an example of the bigger conceptual voluntary action thing that he valued so much. You know, these were people just who saw a need, and they got together and they made it happen in a huge way. So it goes all the way from that sort of thing down to bringing a meal to an elderly person in their home.
George saw it not just as a means of service, it clearly was that, but as a means of saving the nation. Mm-hmm. I mean, he put it in those terms, that we cannot survive as a selfish, as a lustful, as a self-indulgent. He used all those words with passion. Country, we have to give of ourselves. There has to be an outreach of all people. We have to care. And so more than serving people in need was the need of people to serve, the need for people to be involved, to reach out, to engage themselves in a process of loving unconditionally. And that's a big message. I want to go back to one more point, as to his political support. I assume you were all at the 1964 Republican Convention in San Francisco. if you weren't, you should have been there. George gave a fire-breathing speech condemning Barry Goldwater, who just happened to be the nominee for president that year. And George refused to ever support him. He refused to endorse him. He refused to take any positive step. In fact, quite the contrary. And he gave this ringing civil rights speech. I think we have that. In fact, I think there's a quote in here from it.
That we have this one right here.
Yeah.
That we have come almost 200 years from our independence as a nation and 100 years from the Emancipation Proclamation ending slavery without fully recognizing the inherent worth of every individual is our great shame as a nation and as a people. The cause of the millions of Negroes will prevail. July 31st, 1964.
That was the convention in San Francisco. And that was a time when that was not a popular speech. And it certainly wasn't a popular speech with Barry Goldwater becoming candidate. And so in 4 years later, it was kind of a shock that George had any of the numbers, the polling support numbers, given his failure to support the party. And the fact that in Michigan, all of his legislation and all of his achievements were passed with the Democratic House. The Republicans were against him at every turn. And I talked to an individual yesterday, or not yesterday, when did I talk? Cedarburg, last week, who is a legislator in Michigan, who said it was the most remarkable thing, the way George reached out to the Democrats, and he's going to get the last Democrat that voted for his Fair Housing Act, which was the first in the nation, Fair Housing Act, that he had to sell because that was the right thing to do, and the Republican Party rejected it totally to a person, and he carried it, and how he convinced the last lone Democrat to vote for his Fair Housing Act. So those are things that didn't endear him to a party structure, and he struggled with the party. He never did get much support in the party. I asked him that one time.
And he almost wasn't.
Yeah, he was clearly a liberal Republican, and used the term liberal proudly in terms of who he was and what his values were, and so forth. But I never got any more of an explanation. Alan?
Bob.
To what extent does Mitt Romney share some of his father's attributes?
Yeah, we spent some time with Mitt a while back in Boston, and he shares a lot. I think they're very similar kinds of people. There's one fundamental difference. This is a editorial comment, by the way. This isn't fact. But Mitt is much more self-serving than George ever was. And this book, which I apologize, I have not read, but I've read reviews and talked to people who have read it, much more self-serving than George ever would have approved of. Shared values in many respects. I think Mitt's take on his speech on against the same-sex marriage was not... I think it was geared to some awkward political strategies. George was just much more honest and far less calculating in the process. But Mitt made a lot of money. George didn't, and George didn't care about making a lot of money. And George didn't want to be president. If you trust his letters and personal accounts, but he was willing to do it if that's what it took to save the country.
Just a couple of things. George did make a lot of money, actually.
Well, he didn't.
While he was president of American Motors, he made a lot of money. But his pension from American Motors was $42 a month because he wasn't there long enough to vest anything substantial, I guess. And I would modify my opinion about Mitt to say he is somewhat more self-serving than his father. I wouldn't take it to the extent Bonner does, but.
I'm more suspicious of politicians.
Bob in the back.
I just want to say one word about volunteerism. When Mitt's daughter, Jane, lived close to us and was close friends with George and Lenore came to Southern California, we would often see them and have conversations with them. It was during the time that I had been to the Soviet Union and then was also going to the Baltic States to work for the church. And I remember talking to him about the total absence or near absence of volunteerism in other parts of the world. It's very clear to me he saw volunteerism as one of the most vital aspects of the spirit of America, which he was interested in seeing transported abroad. He had a vision of this that I think he was never able to perhaps see come to fruition, that he wanted to see American volunteers not simply flourish in America, but be exported to other countries, because he thought it was such an important part of the revitalization of society.
Thank you.
Clearly. Yeah, I agree.
I'm under the impression that you had to be born in the United States to be president. Was there an exception made here, or what was the reason?
Well, that would have been tested if he had gone on to the nomination. But he was born of parents who were American citizens.
I realize that.
And the fact that they were out of the country at the time of his birth, most constitutional scholars, and I'm not one, I don't know, Reed, did you ever...
It was pretty much cleared up at the time.
Cleared that he would have been acceptable. My daughter was born in Germany, but she can run for president. and so I think that pretty well got resolved. But it was a talking point, for sure.
Yeah. Yes.
Randy?
My dad was a businessman, a friend of George Romney, and the only...
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey. When I was a young boy, the only thing I remember him talking about was that they agreed on, not so much on their politics, as they agreed on the idea that the individual is the solution. And if there's a reason he kept his republicanism, my conscience, it was just that notion that Republicans were a little bit more oriented toward individual initiative versus collective solutions. And so, but he had this wonderful mix.
He did.
The individuals need to get together to do the collective solution.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be, and it's that mix that really does lack in our society. We are polarized on that idea that it's either an organized institution or it's this radical individualism. We need George.
good point. I think that's a good insight, Randy. I think that the notion of community needs reinventing or redefinition. But it's not a community that's dictated by government. And I think that's your point, that George was not willing to have it dictated by government or by big labor or by big business, but all three had to come together in terms of an emergent community logic. For serving, solving problems, and so forth. Key issue.
Everybody can be like he was.
Well, that's what...
Problem solvers because there's a problem.
That's what Lenore said. When Lenore would introduce George, she would always start out by saying, looking around and sort of in her very articulate and very precise language, which was not George's style, she would give her little speech of introduction and what he was. And then her final line always was, "My hope for America is that everybody could be like George." Another issue, the President's Summit. Are you aware that that was George Romney's effort when Clinton and Ford and Bush
and Carter
and Reagan. I guess Nancy Reagan. Ronald was, I guess,
right,
with Alzheimer's by then,
right,
came together for the President's Summit in 1997. But this was George. He's the one that beat on the door of these people. He's the one that called them up. He's the one that went to the White House and would always get in. He would never go through security. He would always get there. He'd say, "You've got to have this summit. We've got to sensitize America to this issue." And it was that summit that spawned Colin Powell's America's Promise. And the Points of Light had come a little earlier, but it translated, and then George's Volunteer Centers of America all got sort of consolidated and pulled together under an umbrella.
Points of Light.
Points of Light umbrella. But it was George that did all these things. He would just beat and beat and beat until people finally gave in.
And the summit really was, I'm sorry, we've just got a couple minutes left. The summit really was the culminating thing that he just lived for the last few years of his life. And Mitt and Ann, his wife Ann, said that that George and Lenore would call every Sunday night and all their children and sort of catch up. In the last few years, all George wanted to talk about was who he had talked to that week, who had come on board with the summit and who hadn't. And Mitt said, you know, you just pick up the phone and he'd start on that. And he said, we would just put the phone down and come back a little later. They got so tired of it. But, he just beat on that drum incessantly. And when he died, before it happened, some of the top leaders in the country around these issues got together and said, we have to pull off what George's vision. We have to do this in honor of George, and they did it.
And it spawned all kinds of organizations. I think we take
yes.
one more fast.
In terms of the family, how did George relate to the Romneys of Utah and the church?
I asked Elder Haight that question, and he said he was a master at maintaining his faith-based integrity in a world of liberal activism. And I said, you know, I know some others who have tried that, Elder Haight, and they haven't been quite so successful. And again, his answer, God made George unique so he could do that. But he maintained it very well. He would not only bust into the White House, he'd bust into 47 East South Temple the same way. And he was never turned down anywhere. His presence was just so compelling, and his commitment was so strong, and his motives were so simple. His motives were never calculating, they were never self-serving, they were always so simple that nobody in good faith could ever shut him out, because nobody was suspect of what he was trying to do. He was so upfront and so clear and made it so open that he just overpowered everybody. Have we overstated George Romney?
Yeah. This is a challenge in the book because we don't want to make him into a superhuman hero, you know. But he was heroic. So it's challenging to balance and make him a human being, which he was. He had his flaws.
But to quote Greg Petersmeyer, who was the executive director of Points of Light, America's Promise?
America's Promise.
He says, "I love George with a passion, but every time he came to see me, it scared the hell out of me." I just didn't know where I was going to go. Just didn't know how I was going to deal with it. Didn't know how I was going to survive the day. So
that's about
well,
it.
Well, I think let me make a concluding statement. there's a construct in theology that says you should apply scriptures to yourself. I think we should apply this to ourselves. I would like to see a clarion call in the church, in the nation, in the community. And Randy said it rather well. I think we do need that. And George isn't going to come back and do it, so we've got to do it. And we've got to find that process, that level of commitment, that stubbornness in a righteous cause, not stubbornness in a selfish cause, not stubbornness in a personal self-aggrandizing cause, but stubbornness in the cause of loving and serving humankind. Stubbornness in the sense of bringing a community together and solving problems and transcending conflicts and in the paradigm I like to use these days of peacemaking, of really reaching out to find a way to transcend and to build that world that loves and serves and commits herself quite independent of political platform, self-aggrandizing options and money-making greed, and sort of an alternative to reality television. That's what George Romney is.
Thank you.
That's fun, see?